It's a very simple little quiz. And the purpose of this is to check our frame of reference to see if we really picked up anything last week. Okay? And we're going to do that, and then we're going to have our study afterward. Okay? So each one take one of these. And you don't have to put your name on. We're not going to grade them. Is there, might be a blank one in there. Is there a blank one in there? How you doing? Oh, you're not allowed to, you're not allowed to look at your notes. I got to get the guys in the tape room too. Just, I used to teach school and I just sort of miss it, so. Get them back here. You see, there's a wife already looking out to make sure her husband gets it. She doesn't want to get him left out. I'll get him back here. I already warned him. Okay, now I want you to listen to something. Now, this is real easy. You could do this without knowing the historical books because I've already listed them. But what I want you to do is, over on the right, I want you to put all the rest of the Old Testament as they relate to these books. Well, just see if you can, see, and then you'll see how much, see, you picked up more than the assignment. Gee, you learned a little more than you had to. I mean, okay, go. As they relate, like we gave last week. No. You were supposed to look at them all week. Okay, go. This is the way you check up, see if you learned anything. Total recall, hardest test there is. Time events and people happenings in terms of time event sequence. They are Genesis, Exodus, Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, latter part of Numbers, Joshua, Judges, 1 Sam, 2 Sam, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah. See how easy that is? There they are all listed. Okay. Now, all the rest of the books of the Old Testament, if you weren't here last week, you want to write this down in your notes, it'd be a good idea. All the rest of the Old Testament fits in as the time is moving. The books that's written contemporaneous with the events of Genesis is the book of Job. The events are contemporaneous. They are not written contemporaneously. Okay? With Exodus comes the book of Leviticus. With Numbers comes the book of Deuteronomy. With Judges comes the book of Ruth. With 1 Samuel, nothing. With 2 Samuel comes 1 Chronicles, 1st 11 chapters, and Psalms. Oh, pardon me. Huh? No, not Proverbs. Proverbs comes with 1 king, doesn't it? Yeah. Right? 1 king. Okay, now look. Watch how easy this is. With 1 king come 1st Chronicles B and 2nd Chronicles A. And all the books of whom? Solomon. Proverbs, Song of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes. Right? Right. Okay, with 2 kings. Now, 2 kings then is going to take you from Solomon's death down to the captivity. Right? So who's doing all the writing in that period? Not Jeremiah. Isaiah plus the first 9 of the minor prophets. and you have to get 2 Chronicles B. So here you have 2 Chronicles B, you have Isaiah, you have first 9 of the minor prophets, right? Okay, who are the first 9 of the minor prophets? Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, and... That's 9. I already said 9, yeah. Right there. Got it? Okay, who is contemporaneous with Daniel? Ezekiel and?
Jeremiah.
And Jeremiah happens to write one more book called Lamentations. Esther comes in not there, but with Ezra. And with Ezra, we have Esther plus the last 3 of the minor prophets. Right? Okay, last 3 of minor prophets, and they are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Got the idea? In this column on your sheet, you have the books that carry the historical narrative from the creation story all the way to the close of the canon. In this column, you have the books that in some way relate to the events of these books in time. That's what we had last week, okay? Okay. Now this week, we're going to start with the 13 major sections of Old Testament history, and I'm going to give you 2 of them tonight. And they're all going to follow the same pattern. There will be 13 major divisions of Old Testament history. There'll be 13 of these when we're done. Okay? 13 major divisions of Old Testament history. Tonight we're going to pick up Numbers 1 and 2. Now all of these will follow the same pattern. So, what I'd suggest you do on these is take, if you have a little notebook, you take a whole page. Let's say you have a 5x7 type notebook. Take a whole page for each one and just put Roman numeral 1 up there, see? And what we'll have over here is we'll have the division title. Then we'll have the dates, because history happens in time, place. There'll be people involved, so we'll have the scriptural portion next. Scriptural portion. And then we'll have people and events, or key people and events, and then we'll have other nations. Okay? In other words, every one of these are going to have 5 major things that I want you to know about each one, right? Right. See? They're all going to be the same in terms of what I want you to know about each one. So, to fill up a page, we'd have division number 1, which would be universal dealings. Universal dealings. We said last week that history is important because God opted to reveal himself in time, space, people-oriented circumstances. That is one definition of history. The better that we orient to history, and particularly to divine viewpoint of history, the better we understand what God is doing in history, if he is doing anything, which is in question today. He is doing something, but people are questioning it. The first one is universal dealings, and here we have circa CA 10,000 BC, and it takes us up to the time of Abraham, which is 2166 BC. Okay? CA means circa, means about. Now, in this church, we did a 5-month study on the historicity and the historical aspects of Genesis 1 through 11. I'm not going to go over this period again. We've already done that. Scripture portion that covers universal dealings is Genesis chapters 1 through 11. Okay? The key people and events are creation, and then Adam to Abraham, right? Right. In other words, as you open your Bible, it becomes very obvious if you're at all observant that God is in a hurry to get to Abraham. All right, here's the Old Testament of my Bible. I'm going to hold it up for you. The Old Testament of my Bible covers that much. See that? That's page 3 to 984. It's 981 pages. All right, he takes this amount of pages, which is 17 pages. He takes 17 pages to cover from the creation all the way to Abraham, which is a vast amount of period of time. Doesn't even tell us how much time it is. He's not interested in telling us how much time it is. Then he takes that many pages to cover from Abraham to the close of the canon, which is from 2166 B.C. to 400 B.C., which is approximately 1,700 years. That amount to cover 1,700 years of history, this amount to cover thousands of years of history. Now, it's obvious, then, that God is interested in getting to Abraham as fast as he can, and then the rest of the Old Testament is going to concern itself with Israel. And the nations will appear only as they relate to Israel in time. They only show up as they have some dealing with Israel. Okay, now he gets to Abraham how? He gets to Abraham, he opts not to go through... He opts not to go through whom? First son. Second son. Cain. Abel. He opts not to go through either of them. He goes through Seth. And? These are very important people. Opts not to go through Seth. Or opts to go through... Well, maybe we won't go the whole list. We won't have time. We go through Seth. We go down 10 generations or 9 generations and we come to Noah, we come to Shem, we go down through about 10 more generations and we come to Abraham. And these are outstanding figures then in the Old Testament, in that period. Okay, the other nations that are involved here would be the land of Shinar, which is ancient Sumer, S-U-M-E-R. Oh boy, that's exciting. The land of Shinar, ancient Sumer. And also the Nubian Valley, which is Egypt. Okay. That is the first major section of Old Testament history. Now, I'm not going to say much about it. I want to go on to the second one. Everybody have that? No? Okay. I'm standing in the way. Let me turn sideways and you can see it. Now I'm standing your way.
No, I got it.
Got it? It's just some of these college kids, they just can't write very fast. Tom Good went to candidate at the church in Steamboat Springs last Sunday, and he said there were 18 college kids, college-age kids, they weren't all in college, in a class, and they didn't have a teacher. 18 in Steamboat Springs. Just fantastic opportunity. Said they were very, very responsive. And they have their own Bible study during the week. I don't know who teaches it, but they have one. These college kids. You might pray for that situation. Okay, let's move on. Second period of Old Testament history. We said we wanted to learn five things. We wanted to learn the name of the period. We want to learn the dates. We want to learn the scripture that covers that portion, the key persons and events and other nations as they came in. Okay, we'll call this period then the patriarchal period. Now, sure, everybody knows. Well, maybe you don't know. Patriarch means father. The period of the fathers means the Hebrew fathers. All right, the period covered runs from 2166 BC to circa 1876 BC. Now, it really goes a little bit farther than that, but that's one of the main things. Terminus ad quem and terminus ad quo or something like that. CA 10,000 BC would be creation. No use putting a date down without knowing what it is, right? 2166 would be the birth of Abraham. The birth of Abi, who is the father of the Hebrew nation. Over here then, 2166 will relate back to this. And 1876 will be Jacob and one man's family to Egypt. Let's put it down that way. One man's family. Da 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 da. Did you ever hear One Man's Family on the radio? What'd you say? That was a song that introduced it. Bet you remember, they have this old time radio now coming back. What? Oh, I used to listen to that all the time. This is one man's family to Egypt. The one man is Jacob with 70 souls. Goes down in 1876 BC. All right, the scriptural passage that covers this is Genesis chapter 12, birth of Abraham. Well, see, Abraham's born in 11, but this picks up the thread in Genesis 12 through Genesis 50, we'll say. He actually goes down in Genesis 47, but we'll carry it on through. Okay, the key characters then would be the fathers, right? They are Abraham, and then the seed will pass through Isaac, and from Isaac to Jacob, and from Jacob to Noah. That's the story, and he's the key character, but the seed will pass through Judah. And parenthetically, key interest in the story is Joseph, but he is not in the lineage of the Savior. So he's a key figure. Let's put him down out here, Joseph. Okay? And the stories in that period relate mainly to these key figures. All right, other nations that are involved would be the old kingdom, old Egypt kingdom, and middle Egypt kingdom. Now, when we come to Exodus, we'll outline the history of Egypt for you. But in these two periods, you have the old kingdom and the middle kingdom, and then you have the old Babylonian kingdom. You also have the Second Sumerian Renaissance, but I'm sure you won't have to worry too much about that. Do you know that there's a man at Harvard that he's a historian, and all he teaches at Harvard is the 100 years of the Second Sumerian Renaissance. Now listen. Be honest with me. How many in here ever heard of the Second Sumerian Renaissance? If you heard of it, raise your hand. Besides my wife, I mean, I'm always telling her about it. There is a man at Harvard who teaches in history the Second Sumerian Renaissance. That's all he teaches. Most people have never heard of that, you know. What it indicates is the more and more you learn and the smarter and smarter you get, the less and less you teach. The more specialized you become and the more withdrawn you become. Now, it ought not to be that way. That's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. That man probably has a wealth of knowledge that he could share, and he's probably sharing it with a handful of graduate students in some seminar in some stuffy library room. Well, some people want that, but that's... Okay, all right. Okay, next week, when you come back here, then you know these two periods. See, now here, what we have done here is we have gone back and we have picked up this first historical book and given you the major concept of that first historical book. And all of those names will resurrect stories for you, if you know the story of Genesis. Now, if you are unfamiliar with your Bible, then I would suggest that before next week, every day, sit down and read some of these chapters between Genesis 12 through 50. That's 38 chapters. Just start at the 12th chapter and just start reading and get familiar with the story, the narrative, the historical narrative. See the way it goes. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them for you next week. All right. Now, these are all facts, see? And facts can be sterile and cold and unreal sometimes. So what I'm going to do under some of these periods is, I'm not going to try to teach this chronological. It'll take me 20 years. I'm going to pick out stories from these passages, some of which you'll be familiar with and some of which you're not familiar with. You want to remember now what we said the Bible is doing is, what is being done in the Bible is that God is revealing himself. He is revealing himself through time, space, people-oriented happenings. He is revealing himself in history. He's telling us things about himself. And sometimes you read the story and you don't get the message. So I'm going to pick out some of the stories and I'm going to show some of the things that God is indicating about himself in the Old Testament. Got it? Everybody with me now? Next week we'll pick up point 3 of the 13 outstanding divisions of the Old Testament. We'll just pick them up one at a time each week because, see, that'll give you a chance through the week to look at your notes and get oriented to these and do some memorization so that by the time we get done, you'll have that whole Old Testament. You'll just be able to write it all out by total rote memory. You'll know all the events and how they happen right in sequence. See, we can really have a Wallop-a-losing test. All right, I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 38. It's a chapter that I've never heard taught in church except by me. Now, one of the reasons that you don't hear it taught in church is because a commentary says that this is not suitable material to teach to a mixed audience. They sort of shy away from it. I think it's very suitable. I think it's very important. Another reason you don't hear it taught is that people can't figure out what the importance is of it. So, what we want to do, or what I want you to do while we're teaching the story, is try to get some idea of why in the world does God have this story in the Bible? This is a terrible story. And yet it occupies a prominent place in the first book of the Bible. And it interrupts the narrative, even. He interrupts the narrative to do it. The narrative of Exodus runs like this, or of Genesis. It runs, first of all, with Genesis 1 through 11, and you're hurrying from creation, as we said, to Abraham. Some very outstanding events categorized there. Then we pick up Abraham in Genesis 12 through 25. Then we pick up Isaac, just a few chapters about him, in chapter 25b through maybe 27. Whoop, I did that wrong, didn't I? Genesis 25b through 27, you have Isaac. Then you have Genesis chapters 28 through 37, and you have Jacob. And then you have Genesis chapter 37 through 50, and you have Joseph. But right in here at chapter 38, you have a story about Judah. All right. Let's read. And it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren. verse 1. At that time is the time of Joseph's betrayal by his brothers. Now the problem with Judah in the case is that all the brothers rejected Judah's advice. Well, that's not true, is it? They didn't reject his advice. They took his advice. The problem appears to be that that Judah... Which one did they reject? I was thinking it was Judah. Reuben's advice. Yeah, Reuben said, let's not kill him. Well, Judah said the same thing. Yeah, Judah encouraged them to sell him. It appears that Judah is disturbed by this whole event. So he leaves his brethren in the northern part of Palestine. And it says he turned into a certain Adullamite. Now, turned in is an expression looks like this, Wayet Ayish. And what that Ayish means to pitch. Now, it generally means it assumes that you pitch a tent. But it can mean to bend also. So when it says he turned in, it means he either pitched his tent, which means he set up sort of housekeeping there, or he inclined himself to. Now, the man that he inclined himself to happens to be an Adullamite, Hira the Adullamite. Okay, that means he's a Canaanite. And probably an unbeliever. Now this is going to get Judah in trouble. I want to show you where this place is. You remember Adullam is the place where David hid in the cave. Remember when he was being pursued by Saul. Land of Palestine looks something like this. Key geographic markings in Palestine is the Carmel. Carmel Mountain, end of the Dead Sea, and across from which is the city of Jerusalem. And then Bethlehem, which is just south of Jerusalem. And Adullam was right here. It's just west of Bethlehem, 20-some miles, near the foothills of the Central Range. And the mountains are smaller, hence they're called the Shephelah. So Judah has traveled from up in this area down here. And he's probably looking for some place to identify. And he begins to identify in his mentality with the Canaanites. Now in verse 2, he further identifies with the Canaanites by taking a Canaanite wife. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. Now, I don't know if it had any bearing on his marrying her, but Shua happens to mean opulence or riches. Now, I don't know, of course, some of these names, this did not necessitate that she was rich. Maybe her father, when he named her, maybe he wished she'd be rich. So he named her Shua. My name is Charles. Charles means, my middle name, Charles means strong. That's why everybody calls me Ron. Some people try to take the names out of the Bible and make sort of a mystical meaning out of the words. Be careful with that. You'll get you in trouble. It happens her name meant riches and opulence, and maybe she was rich and maybe she was opulent, and maybe that's what attracted Judah. But the big problem was he was out of fellowship. He might have married anybody. So he took this girl to wife, and he went in unto her, which is one of the biblical expressions for having sexual relations with her, of course. And she conceived, verse 3, and she bare a son, and he called his name Er. And she conceived again and bare a son. And notice that he called, this is a beautiful historical sub-point. But according to some Hurrian customs that they've uncovered in secular materials, the father named the first child. It was his option to name the first one, and then the mother could name the rest. And it's very interesting that you have that borne out here in the Bible. You notice that the first one, he called his name Er, and she conceived again and bare a son, and she called his name Onan. And she conceived again and bare a son, and she called his name Shelah. The meanings of these names are not overly critical. In some cases, they're just guessing at the meaning of them. We don't know for sure. Er could mean either watcher. It could mean enmity. Onan can mean strength. Shelah can mean weak or drooping, or it can even mean rest. Names are overly important. Now notice that it says about Shelah that he was at Chizib. So she, anyhow, here we have Shua, and here we have Judah, and they tie the knot, and out of that union comes Er, Onan. Well, we shouldn't list them that way. We should list them this way. Er, Onan, and Shelah. Now these two are going to die, and then there's only going to be Shelah left. And we're told that Shelah was born in the town of Chizib, or Chezib, place name. Now the reason that you have that is that Shelah is going to live, and he is going to be of the offspring of Judah. Hence, the chance that through him might come whom? Messiah. Right. And that's why the place name is important. Later on, that name will go down in some of the chronicles as a place of the ancestral city of some of the offspring of Judah. All right, let's go on with the story. Verse 6. And Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. Her name means palm tree. Very probably a Canaanite, since her father lives in this immediate vicinity. Ah. Now that means that he had lived there at least, let's say, let's give her 9 months to have the child. Let's give her a month in between pregnancies. That'd be 10 months. That'd be 30 months for three children. That's kind of rushing the situation, but maybe they did. I don't know. I work out in a gym with a guy who has 13 children. And he only has one wife that I know about. Let's allow that. That would be 30. And then you have to allow time for them to grow up. So and apparently they married very, very young. Maybe Er was 15, maybe he was 16. We don't know. But anyhow, Judah takes a wife. Now, in choosing a wife, he opts, again, for a Canaanite, Tamar, a Canaanite wife. For Er. Now that means that Judah had done two things that his father would advise him against. One was that he married a Canaanite, and now he marries off his firstborn to a Canaanite. If Judah would have consulted his father Jacob, Jacob would have said, no way. You won't have my blessing in that marriage, not at all. But he didn't consult his father. And then he makes the mistake of choosing for his son. He is out of fellowship. So verse 7, Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord. Now when you have that phrase, in the sight of, here we have verse 7, that literally means in the eyes of Jehovah. In the eyes of Jehovah. Now what was he in the eyes of the Jehovah? He was evil in the eyes of Jehovah. And that means, from divine viewpoint, this man was utterly corrupt in the estimation of God. Now that, really, if you think about it, the only way that you can define evil is from Jehovah's eyes, from God's eyes. If you start defining evil from human viewpoint, you will find 90 million definitions of what is evil. You will get into the John Dewey concepts of relativism, and you will have to become a relativist if you begin defining evil, or even good, from human viewpoint. This is precisely where the universities are in our country and in the whole world today. Because they reject divine viewpoint and divine expression on what is good and what is evil. And so if you talk to anybody who's a university type, he will immediately, if you begin to talk about relative good and relative evil, he will immediately lapse into these relativistic arguments. There is absolutely no way to know what is evil and what is good apart from an absolute God who reveals himself. And that's the God that we have. And that's the God that the Bible describes. So from divine viewpoint, in divine estimation, this man was evil. Now it says in the King James that the Lord slew him, verse 7. Now that would either have to be an intensive stem or a hifil stem for that to be translated that way. I looked for other translations but couldn't find any. But I looked up the Hebrew verb, which looks like this. Here is the Hebrew verb, me'oth, or muth. Muth. Now, muth means to die. And the form that you have here means the Lord let him die. The Lord let him die. He doesn't tell us how the man died. The Lord just let him die. It wasn't so much that the Lord caused him to die. But you could say, well, the Lord didn't let him live, and you could rationalize and then say, hence the Lord caused him to die. But we don't know the details of the situation, of it, precisely what happened. Everyone that I read on it, said, they speculate, and they said it probably was a sexual sin, since the Canaanites were so perverted. All right, let's see what happens. Verse 8, and Judah said to Onan, go in unto thy brother's wife, and marry her, and raise up seed to her, to thy brother. Now, verse 8 was a Hurrian custom, an ancient Mideast custom. And the law was this. This was a Hurrian law. It was sort of a social law that an unmarried brother-in-law, let's put it that way, was responsible to produce offspring or a seed. This would be the word seed. In the event, produce offering by his brother's wife. By his brother's wife. In the event the brother died without seed or without producing a seed. Now that Hurrian custom becomes a part of the Old Testament law. You will read in Deuteronomy, see this, in Deuteronomy 25 and verse 5. This becomes part of the Old Testament covenant, part of Sinaitic covenant. It would be fun to chase out the details of why that was so, but we won't have time. In fact, we don't even have time to look it up. Remember, the Sinaitic covenant comes when? What year? 1445 B.C. Part of 46, yeah, around 46. This year that we're in here in Jacob's life is somewhere in around the year 2000 B.C. Okay. When the Pharisees come to Jesus and they try to trap him, they say, here's a guy, had a wife, and he died. And he didn't have any seed, so his brother took her to wife. And then he died. And then his another brother took her to wife. Then he died, another brother. And this happened seven times. Remember that? Matthew 22? And then the Pharisee says, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? And Jesus says, what's the matter? Haven't you been reading your Bible? In the resurrection, they're neither married nor given in marriage. Marriage is for earth, and not for the eternal state of our beings. Yeah. Same concept was true in Jesus' day. This is called the law of the Levirate marriage. The law of the Levirate marriage. All right, so according to this ancient tradition, Judah, who was responsible for the marriage of his children, says, okay, Onan, your turn. You take her to be your wife, and you produce a seed. Now, you want to remember that involved here is all of Judah's, Judah's, no, his, when you will your stuff, what do you call that? Judah's, estate. Judah's estate. And Judah's estate is to be like, see, go out like this. Here is Er, and he marries Tamar, and over here is Onan, and over here is Shelah. See? But now he's gone, and there's no offspring, see? So Onan now is commanded to go over and produce a seed, and that means another third of the cut, see? So he doesn't like that. Verse 8. Judah said to Onan, go in unto thy brother's wife and marry her. Now, if Onan had been married, he would not have been permitted to do this, but he was single, see? Not only marry her, but raise up seed to thy brother. In other words, the seed that Onan would produce in Tamar would not be looked upon as his own seed, but a seed to inherit that part of the estate. And it so happened that Er was the firstborn, and it's very logical that the primary aspects of Judah's estate would have gone to Tamar's seed. Onan doesn't like it. And Onan knew that the seed should not be his. Verse 9, that's the key concept in what he did. It came to pass that when he went in unto his brother's wife, he spilled it, meaning he spilled his semen on the ground, lest that he should give his seed to his brother. See, the Bible qualifies what it was. It was a concept of the seed. Later on in history, this thing that Onan did becomes known as the sin of Onanism. You look it up in your dictionary. It's in any good dictionary. The sin wasn't his spilling of his semen. The sin was that he didn't want his brother to have a seat because it was taking a third out of his pocket. This thing displeased the Lord, wherefore he slew him also. Same verb, same stem, same tense, means he let him die. All right? Now watch Judah. So here's Judah. Now he's lost two sons. And Tamar's involved, and she's a Canaanite. And he has been down in this area of Adullam. He's been down there for at least maybe 17 years, maybe 18 or 19 years. And now he is thinking like the Canaanites. Look at verse 11. Then said Judah to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at thy father's house till Shelah, my son, be grown. And then it says in the King James, for he said, but that is not an expression or an express statement. That is a thought, an unexpressed thought. For he said in his mind, boy, if she marries Shelah, he's liable to die too. In other words, he is saying this woman got a jinx on her. He's as superstitious as the world. And he didn't plan to give Shelah to her at all. He didn't plan that at all. He just wanted to get rid of her. And he said, well, the best way to get rid of her is send her back home, and I'll tell her a lie. So he lies to her. And he says, when Shelah's old enough, he'll be your husband, he'll produce seed, and we'll consider that as Er's seed. And he's thinking in his mind, boy, she's jinxed. And I'm liable to lose my other son. Okay. So she does it. Verse 11, latter part. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. And in the process of time, and that literally says, and the days grew many. And the days grew many, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. So now Shua dies. Here's Judah. He's married to Shua. And she died. So she's gone. And, pardon? Pardon?
Well, it doesn't say that Shua's daughter.
Oh, I'm sorry. The daughter of Shua. I'm sorry. Yeah, I keep calling her Shua. I'm sorry. Shua's daughter. I'm sorry. Shua is the Canaanite that's mentioned in verse 2. Yeah. The Canaanite was named Shua. Shua is the father of his wife, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Okay, so Shua's daughter is gone. Who is? What? Yeah, the daughter, she is Shua's daughter. Shua is a Canaanite. He is the Canaanite of verse 2. No, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife. The Canaanite is named Shua, and his daughter is named, well, you don't have her name. The concept is that this man was a Canaanite and his daughter was a Canaanite. In other words, Judah married into the Canaanite line. Okay. Important thing is not so much who this is as the fact that time is now elapsing. And days grew many. And Judah was comforted. Means he was comforted after his grief over his wife. Okay. And the time was for him for sheep shearing. So Judah decides to join the sheep herders who were, and this was a kind of a joyous time of the year. So he decides to make a trip to see the men who were watching over his sheep. And you want to remember that Judah was a pretty wealthy fellow at this time. So he decides to make a trip to Timnath. Now, there is a Timnath in this area down here, but it isn't too likely. It's not too far from Elam. It's not too likely that this is the Timnath in view here. It's more likely there was another Timnath way up north. So he decides to go up there anyhow. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you'll find a number of spellings. Yeah, same way in a...
Same one,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and he's going to take this his friend, Hiram the Elamite, with him. Okay, so there they go. Verse 13. And it was told Tamar, saying, "Behold, thy father-in-law goeth up to Timnath to shear his sheep." Now that's referring, of course, to Judah. And remember now, Tamar is living with her father. Verse 14. Now, how much time passed, we don't know, but enough time for Shelah to be old enough to be her husband. Now, how many years that took and so on, we don't know, or how much the length of time, we don't know. But it was enough time that he could have married her. And she realizes what's going on. So in verse 14 it says, "And she put on her widow's garments," or she put her widow's garments off from her. She now has a plan. "And she covered her not with a veil, but with the veil. And she wrapped herself and sat in an open place," literally in the entrance to a town called Enayim, which is on the way to Timnath. "For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given unto him to wife." Now, this veil is the veil of a harlot. It is not a veil, it is the veil. Now, it is not the veil of any harlot. This is the covering of a harlot. But not just any harlot. She is going to be called, in verse 21, this is Judah later on saying, when he asks the men of that place, says, "Where is the harlot?" The word is Quedeshah, looks like this. Quedeshah. Now, Quedeshah means a temple harlot. In other words, if this wouldn't be irreverent, she would be a sacred harlot. That's right. That's what Leupold calls her. Calls her a sacred harlot. In other words, a harlot who was identified with the Canaanite fertility worship. See, in case you're not up to that. This meant that she identified with Canaanite fertility worship. Now, in all the ancient fertility cults, see, you have this concept that sex is part of worship. So you would have priests and priestesses that would involve in fornication and so on. Now, she dresses that way. All right, verse 16. Time, boy, getting away. I thought we'd been through this by now. Verse 15. "When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot." In other words, he wasn't confused. He thought her to be what she was masquerading to be, only he didn't know it was Tamar. Verse 15, "because she had covered her face. And he said unto her," by the way, now remember, I didn't write this. "He said, go to," only "go to," just like in Greek, in Hebrew, means, "hey, come here," or "looky here now, I pray thee. Let me come in with thee," for he knew not she was his daughter-in-law. He just thought she was a harlot. And she says, "What wilt thou give me?" So she says, let's strike up a deal here. What do you got to offer? He says, "Man, I got a lot to offer." He says, "I got this whole flock up here in the hill." He says, I'll send you a goat from the flock." And she says, "How do I know you're going to send me a goat from the flock? Better give me a pledge. Give me a down payment. Until you send it. In other words, I don't trust you. I want some evidence, concrete evidence that will prove that you're going to do this. Verse 18, and he says, what pledge will I give you? And she says, give me thy signet, which is his seal. Verse 18. Signet means a seal. Now, there were several kinds of seals. Maybe a ring, or possibly a little sort of tubular cylinder. The Babylonians had those types of seals. But it was some marking that was distinguishable to Judah and identified with him. And the bracelets meant the cords. Bracelets are not too good of a translation. Bracelets were cords that held the ring, or cords that held the seal. And since she wanted his staff. Okay. And he said, and she says, I'll take your seal, your bracelets, and your staff. And he gave it to her. And he came in unto her, and she conceived by him. And she arose and went her way and laid by her veil from her and put on the garments of her widowhood. And Judah sent the kid by hand of his friend, the Edomite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he found her not. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, where is the Gedesha that was openly by the wayside or by the entrance? And they said, there's no harlot in this place. There's no Gedesha here. And he returned to Judah and says, I can't find her. And also the men of the place said that there was no Gedesha in this place. And Judah says, oh, well, let her take it to her. Let it ride. She can keep my signet and and the cords that held it. Lest we be ashamed, lest we all make fools out of ourselves. Behold, I sent the kid, and you haven't found her. We'll just forget about it. Verse 24. And it came to pass about 3 months after that it was told Judah, saying, Tamar, thy daughter-in-law, hath played the harlot. And also, behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judah says, bring her forth, and we'll burn her. Now, Adullam is in Judah. It's within the boundaries of Judah. And you don't have any burning of harlots. You have stoning. They could stone them, but you don't burn them. Burning must have been some Canaanite thing that he had picked up. That's how far he'd gone. You'll never find the concept of grace originating with men in the Bible. When she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by that man whose these are, am I with child? Now, when she's brought forth, does that mean they brought her out of the house? There she is in that little town where Judah's living. Here they bring her out, and she comes walking out with a big smile on her face. She said, recognize these things? Discern, I pray thee, who these are. Did you ever see this signet before? Did you ever see these cords? Did you ever see this unique staff? And, you know, a staff then was like, you know, a private gun, you know, with a nice checkering on it and gold inlay and put your name on there and everything. And Judah acknowledged, verse 26, them and said, she is more righteous than I, meaning she is more in the right than I am, because that I gave her not to Shelah my son, and he knew her again no more, which meant there is that word no used for sexual relations. I mean, he didn't have any more sexual relations with her. It came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in a room. And it came to pass when she travailed that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying this came out first. But that didn't happen. It came to pass he drew back his hand, and behold, his brother came out. And she says, hast thou broken forth? Or how hast thou broken forth? This breach be upon you. Really, it means she names his name Pharez, which really means a forging through. you forged through ahead of your brother, which looked like he'd be born first. And afterward came out his brother that had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name is called Zerah. I found about six meanings for that name, so I don't know which one's right. Pharaoh's name means breaking through. Thus endeth the story. Now you go on to the next chapter, and Joseph was brought down to Egypt. When you end chapter 36, Joseph is sold in Egypt. When you pick up chapter 37, Joseph is sold in Egypt. When you pick up 39, Joseph is down in Egypt. In between, the story of Judah. And not a very nice story for one of the patriarchs, one of the fathers. But a true story. Historical, actual happening. All right? Why is it there? Okay, Matthew 1 is why it's here. Okay, that's the first reason. That's the big one. Matthew 1 is why it's there. So here we had then Judah, and he married the Shua's daughter. And out of Shua's daughter came Er, Onan, and Shelah. And Er got tied up with Tamar, and he dies, and Onan dies, and Shelah doesn't get hooked up with her, but Judah does, and out of Judah Tamar comes Phares. And when you read Matthew 1, this is the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac, Isaac begat Jacob, Jacob begat Judas, which is Judah, and his brethren. And Judah begat Phares and Zerah of Tamar, the one who played the harlot in Genesis 38. And Phares begat Hezron. So out of here comes Phares, spelled this way, in Hebrew, filled with an S in Greek. And out of Phares down the line comes Jesus Christ. And in that line you have several others. You have Rahab. You have Bathsheba. So on. You have Ruth. Five women named in that list. Only one of them. Ruth was a Gentile. Tamar was a Canaanite. Bathsheba was Jewish. Mary was Jewish. Rahab was a Canaanite. So three out of the five were Canaanites. Are the women mentioned in the genealogy of Christ. And this son, Phares of Tamar, is in the genealogy of Christ. Now, what does that tell us? God in his grace rises above the sin and folly of man in order to bring to pass his own purposes. And if he didn't do that, his purposes would never come to pass. This is one of the best illustrations of the grace of God in the Old Testament.